Shall I just hook this on my own? Okay. All right, today's message is called Living by Grace. Now, to give you a little bit of a background, I brought copies of two prior messages, which this one follows on from. One is Saved by Grace. Okay, if you understand the difference, this is Saved by Grace. I've got six copies. You can have a tape of this. This is where I explain the teaching of grace by justification rather than by works of the law, as he explained, and the basis of the teaching of the doctrine of grace. Today's sermon is Living by Grace, which I think you will then immediately see the difference in the two ideas that I have here, though really they're part of the whole subject. But I really can't go back over and cover that information, so I have some tapes here for you. I also have another set of tapes, which is called Growing in Grace and Knowledge, which is the one I gave at the Ladies' Weekend. Some of you have already heard this. This should really be more of the final sermon, but I gave it first since that was the theme of the Ladies' Weekend. All right, so I have that one here too, but it's a part of this series that I'm doing. Whether I will do yet another series on the subject of grace, which I think I really need to have one more, I'll see how we go. But it's very important that we understand this subject. So last time we discussed that we were saved by grace. From start to finish, salvation is a gift. And as he said in Romans 3:24, which we quoted, we are justified freely by his grace, and we explored a little bit about what that means. And that is essentially this: you did not deserve it. You were not called because of who you were or what you did. You had nothing that you could present to God to say, well, this is why God called me. That's not why he called you. God gave his grace without regard to your past, nor assurance as to what you might do with it in the future. He didn't choose you with that in mind. God can save anybody. A person can have a pretty bad past. A person can have a lot of things against him. God can bring that person through it. God is able to save anybody. The glory will never go to us. It will always go to him because of what he does. So when God called you to salvation, it was a gift. It was not by works. You cannot point to anything that we ever did. But we also found out that grace does not make void the law of God. There are works that God expects, but the understanding of grace has come to mean, by a lot of people, meaning the observance of God's holy and righteous laws are not required for salvation. That's how some people understand the idea of being saved by grace through faith. And we are saved by grace through faith. But the way that is generally taken is that we do not have to observe God's law. Now, I explained all of that last time. Today I want to talk about living by grace, as I've already said. Now, some of us don't know how to respond to God's grace. We're simply not used to it. We're not used to thinking that way. And not understanding nor appreciating the grace of God, we are then not released from our past in the way we should. We're not released from the bondage that we were once in that kind of holds us back. We do not experience the proper freedom that we could experience if we understood what that grace really means. Proper understanding of the grace of God, appreciation for the grace of God, makes all the difference in a person's life. In fact, it was designed to do that. It makes all the difference. And as I suggested last time, it is the failure to understand the grace of God and the way God intended it that can be at the root cause of so many of the difficulties that we experience right here in God's church. We tend not to talk too much about grace because we think by doing so we may give the impression that we are somehow minimizing God's law. But then if you emphasize one over the other, That is, if you emphasize, well, you know, we've got to keep God's law and so on, okay, which of course we do, then what we tend to do is we don't fully understand grace. And in not doing so, we don't understand what it means then to live by grace. I think a lot of us don't understand what it means to, first of all, be saved by grace, but then what does it mean then to live by grace? We also live with the ethic that what we get, we have to earn. We say there is no free lunch. And we also say we don't get what we want sometimes because we don't deserve it. Now, all of this is true and ruled by law. But there is another factor that Paul says that actually reigns or supersedes or countermands, and that is the principle of grace. Paul put it this way, grace rules over sin. He didn't say grace rules over law. He did not say that. And that's the mistake a lot of people tend to make. It rules over sin. Grace reigns because of sin. He made that very clear in the 5th chapter of Romans. We really do not get what we deserve. Jesus said when the Pharisees criticized him for eating with the tax collectors and sinners, he said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Jesus also said that you, meaning those who have relied upon the law for salvation or for justification, he says, you've neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. See, grace and law are mutually complementary. They do not contradict one another. They do not oppose one another. They are mutually contradictory. In fact, you can't have one without the other. It's impossible. And a lot of people have never really thought that one out. Because if you have grace in the way most people define it, then why are we talking about law? Well, law is in existence. Therefore, you must have grace. Grace has to do with the forgiveness of sin, which is the transgression of the law. It has nothing to do with diminishing from the law or removing the law. It has nothing to do with that whatsoever. Grace has to do with when we sin. And not only just when, I'm sorry to say if we sin, but I really meant when we sin. That's exactly right, because it's when we sin. And it has to do with the understanding of the condition of the entire human race as to what we are. We are all under sin. I mean, that's the way we are as a result of Adam. So therefore, that it can never, ever be by works. It's impossible for it to be by works because we don't have any. So anything that's happened to us had to occur as a result of God's wonderful generosity being extended toward us without regard to our past, because our past was not good. Our past deserved death. For God to have absolutely nothing to do with us after we chose the way of sin. And that's exactly what we deserve. He went above and beyond that and says, I'll have something to do with them anyway. I won't give them what they deserve. This is grace. Our sins automatically cause us to deserve that. And so he's going to go over and beyond that. He's going to demonstrate grace. In fact, he's going to demonstrate love toward us in a manner in which is so incomprehensible. He's going to demonstrate love toward us in a way that you and I would never do. And that is, he would send his son down to save his enemies. I have a hard time saying hello to my enemies. Let alone giving my life for them. But this is what God did. Okay? Now we enter into a realm of grace which is so far beyond anything that we can comprehend. Now, this is what we should really appreciate. And this then produces a result within us. James said in chapter 2, verse 13, judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Okay, so you got law, you got those who have sinned, then you've got judgment. All of that's going to come into play. God can trump that with mercy. If it wasn't for mercy, folks, it stops at judgment. And you know what happens with judgment. That's it. We're finished. So God has to come with something that reigns or supersedes that or countermands that, and that's mercy. And He does that out of the goodness that is inherent within Him. That's why He does it. Not because you deserve it. So therefore, this is done as a result of what He has chosen to do for people who are unworthy and undeserving, did not earn it, by all rights, shouldn't have it. That's the situation we were in. So we need to really understand the situation that we were in. So there is a greater principle by which God operates than judgment. He doesn't stop at that, and that is He is merciful. And He made provision for His mercy to be shown to us, and that's why it says being justified freely through His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. It is free. It has to be free. No, you know, so far as you're concerned. You didn't pay a price for it. You couldn't have paid a price for it. So therefore, it is free. So let's proceed on then. One's approach toward God's salvation and also His relationship with God could be flawed. Now this takes some understanding and some meditation and prayer to really grasp this. This is what I want to present to you today, that I suspect, and what I am going to say, that I think a lot of times our relationship with God is flawed in the way we approach salvation, in the way we approach our relationship with Him, our ongoing relationship. This is not something that you're going to hear in a sermon and then just go away and say, oh, well, I got it. This sermon is not going to work that way. Okay, the sermon is going to work this way, that you're going to hear what I got to say. A few red flags are going to come up, but then you're going to have to go home and you're going to have to think about it. All right? And see, then, okay, well, what's he really saying here? And you're going to have to ask yourself, what am I doing? And am I living, you know, by grace, or am I doing something else that could be a false religion? So I'm putting it to you in just those terms. Romans 4 and verse 1. Now, I want to start there, and I only covered it very briefly last time. Romans 4 and verse 1. Which illustrates the point that we've just been making. Romans 4, beginning with verse 1. What then shall we say that Abraham our father has found according to the flesh? Now, according to the flesh means what we do on our own, by our own strength, our own intent, and our own goodness. That's what that means. For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. So what he's doing, he's appealing to long before the Jews ever came up with their idea of religion. He's going all the way back to Abraham, long before Moses. And he says, now how was Abraham justified? What does the scripture say? Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now how is that so? Now to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. So, he couldn't have been justified by works. Works means that God would have to have taken note of Abraham's obedience. Abraham was accounted righteous. He was credited with righteousness as a result of believing. Well, why is that? Because Abraham had no works that he could ever point to. He may have been a generally good person. He may have been a decent person, but he still fell into the description that we all fall in, that there is none who is righteous, no, not one. And there is none who seeks God. He did not deserve to be called. He was in the class of all the rest of the human beings who sin, and they had that sin passed on to them because of Adam. He was in Mesopotamia. He wasn't necessarily obedient to God. God simply called him. God spoke to him. God chose him. He had nothing he could point to account for God to call him. He was called by God's grace. This was a free gift. He wasn't calling anybody else. He called Abraham. That was strictly a gift of grace. Now in verse 5, but to him who does not work. Now, a lot of people say, well, that means you don't have to keep God's law. And that's not what it's saying here. It means who doesn't work in order to justify himself. That's what that means. But believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. He's saying Abraham was ungodly. So were we. Just as David describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. Why does he have to do that? You don't have any works that you could ever point to. Nothing. You have absolutely nothing you could point to say that you need to be justified or God's going to... You can't. So, all you have is your belief. That's it. That's all Abraham had. God spoke to him. He says, Abraham, here's what I want you to do. He's got a choice. He's either going to believe him or not believe him at that point. Now, Paul continues the point here. Just as David described the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin. Now, okay, so he's in a blessed state. That is, he's been blessed by God in the sense those lawless deeds are forgiven. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin. Now we find an ongoing state that is beyond that. So, all you have then is faith that you're cleared of that debt. And you're going to simply have to take God up on what He says and that He will do what He says He will do based on what He's already done. And so you are permitted into the presence of God. You are permitted then to have a relationship with God, not having any prior righteousness. And so the past lawless deeds then are removed. So this implies then a future way of dealing with our sin. It doesn't say a person doesn't sin. Everybody sins, but imputed simply means that it is not put on the person's account. So what we have here then is justification through grace after the initial justification. Now, I would feel very nervous. I don't know how you would feel, but I would feel very nervous if it was determined whether I was heard by God or whether God would answer my prayers or my relationship with God depended in any respect, depending on what I did. I would feel a lot better about my relationship with God if I know that I am accepted on the merit of Jesus Christ. I feel a lot better about that. Because if I had to go to God now and say, well, look, you know, I obey you. I do all these nice and wonderful things. Certainly you would like to hear me. Certainly, you know, you would answer my prayers. Does any of us go before God that way? I don't think so. So what I'm saying is, you're justified by grace initially, but you also have to continue to live by grace. How can you still point to what you're doing? This is the story of the Pharisee in the prayer in Luke 18 that Christ pointed to. He said, look at this guy. He's up there saying, Lord, here's what I do. And he just rattles off everything he does. And he expects God to hear him. And God says, no. He says, I'll listen to the other person. Here's the person who is justified. Let me tell you something. When it says a person is not imputed, sins are not imputed to him, his justification has to take place every single day of his life. Yours too. That has to be there. What are you going to point to? To say, well, God, you have to, you know, I'm right before you. God says, I don't think so. you're right before God because God chooses to make you right. He does it initially. He does it every single day of your life after that. So, that's the point I want to make here, right, to start with. Are we justified then by grace? Or do we live by grace then thereafter? Romans chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Here's where Paul comes and makes this point. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have access by faith into this grace in which we stand. We're talking about now a condition, and a permanent condition, as it were, as long as we properly understand this. And that's, and you know, he says it's there. It's not going to depend on how good or how bad you are. See, there's a tendency in all of us that once we've been justified by God's free mercy, then to return to relying on our own efforts to make us right before God. So we get the idea of how hard I work, how deserving I am, and thinking that God has to reward me if I just work a little bit harder, you know. If I'm really obedient, then God must see this and somehow be compelled to give me what I ask for and what I need. And somehow I'll be in better favor with Him the harder I work. And so then our relationship with God becomes based on our performance instead of His grace. That's the point. I want to make that point to people who hold God's law in high esteem. And so we should. Do we then... is our relationship then based on our performance instead of grace? Try it and see what happens. I don't think it will work. Because no matter how good you think your performance is, God will say, not good enough. I appreciate what you do, but I'm sorry, I can't accept you based on that. Because you still fall short of the glory of God. Any particular day that any of you don't fall short of the glory of God? I can't think of any. I've been in this for over 40 years, and I can't think of any day that I've ever come up to the glory of God. Just say, yeah, Lord, I can do this. He says, okay, I'll let you on your own. Let's see how good you are. I appreciate Mr. Nelson's sermonette when he talked about it. He said, we really have to rely. You know, He does provide just about everything. He provides the seed. He provides the weather. He provides everything. Otherwise, it's nothing that we're going to get. And that's just the way. That's what God does for us. So it's a wonderful thing that we have God's grace, and it's important to understand it in that way. I want you to notice here, he says, being justified by faith, you have peace. You ever notice anybody who's trying to justify themselves with the law? They don't seem to have peace. And in fact, I will tell you this. I will go so far, I'm going to deal with this a little bit later on. Because the subject is, remember, living by grace. That one of the fruits of not living by grace is the fact the person does not have peace. And if you don't have peace, I would suggest, as I said before, it goes back to the idea that you don't understand the grace of God in the way we should understand it. It says, you also rejoice in hope of the glory of God. There is joy, or there is rejoicing. You try to work this thing out for yourself and say, take a look at me, Lord. All this merit, I'm here based on my own goodness or my own merit. I don't think that person's a very happy person. I think about this, I think you'll see the truth in that. And you don't have a lot to rejoice in. He even talks about rejoicing in the face of tribulation. A person tends, the first thing we tend to think is that whenever some trial or tribulation happens to us, that, oh, well, we're out of favor with God. I must have done something wrong. If it was based on that, you'd be in and out of favor with God all the time. He talks about the grace in which we stand. It's a permanent thing all the way through. Okay, can we understand that? Can we grasp that point? It's all the way through. God's not up and down like a yo-yo. You and I might fall. You and I might sin, from day to day. And we do. God's grace is there. He's made a decision. He's set His love upon us, just like He told Israel. I set My love upon you. Did they sin? Big time. He says, but it's still there. I'm not taking it away from you. So He's still, He's still there. We're still heard by Him. We still can have that relationship. We can still present ourselves to Him. But we've got to understand the basis on which we do. It's not because of what I'm doing. So, all right, all of us who are law keepers, and so we should be, what do we use the law that way? If we're approaching this in the wrong way. then, and we don't really fully grasp that. We say, if we have performed well, whatever well means, in our opinion, then we expect to be in God's favor and for Him to bless us. If we haven't done so well, our expectations are reduced accordingly. In this sense, we live by works rather than grace. We are saved by grace, but we are living by the sweat of our own performance sometimes. After all, aren't we always challenging each other? Try harder. Isn't that what we say to each other? That's not a bad thing to say, however. But it tends to take on a whole life of itself, which can lead us down a direction that is not quite according to what the Bible is talking about. We seem to believe that ongoing success in salvation, however we define success, is basically up to us. Our commitment, our discipline, our zeal, with some help from God along the way. You know, I am saved by grace, but now I have to pay my way. This tends to be a frame of mind we get into. There could be a definition of grace in our minds that goes like this. Grace makes up the difference between the requirements of His righteous law and what we lack in meeting those requirements. No one is good enough to earn salvation by himself, so God's grace simply makes up what we lack. Some receive more grace than others, but all receive whatever they need to obtain salvation. I want you to think about that one for a minute. The trouble with this definition is that it's simply not true. It's a pretty grave misunderstanding to say that there is some part of what I do is good enough to compare with God. It's a very faulty view of our own plight as sinners before a holy God, because that is what we are. Justification is not meant to be a one-time experience, and this truth needs to be reaffirmed on a daily basis with us. You have to live by grace every single day of your life. Paul himself says, "By the grace of God, I am what I am." That's current. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 10. So, what we're saying is that you can be doing better than somebody else, but you're still saved by grace as much as the person who, in our opinion, is not doing so well. We can't say, "You know, I'm doing better than that person. I don't need very much grace. As a matter of fact, some days I might be able to make it on my own, but that guy needs grace all the time." That can't be true. This is impossible. Justification by works is this, is trying to earn our salvation by our own merit. You cannot do that from day one. You can't do it on day two. You can't do it on day 1050. You just can't do it at all. By earning salvation by your own merit. One of the reasons we don't talk about being saved by grace so much is we think that it will encourage a person to ignore God's law. We think that it will, a person will place less importance on it, dismiss it altogether, or allow himself some indulgences and compromises because he knows that he is under grace. Have people responded to God's grace that way? Absolutely. In fact, most people have. Most people have responded to grace by diminishing and reducing God's law or their observance or respect for God's law. Absolutely they have. Jude 4, what does it say? Here's what they've done. "For certain men have crept in unnoticed." This is right in the church of God. "Who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turned the grace of our God into lewdness," or lasciviousness, meaning lawlessness, "and deny the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ." So we understand, okay, grace comes through Jesus Christ. That was an enormous concept back in the first century. Well, they began to reason by it, and here it took on a whole form of people that just turned God's grace into lawlessness. Paul takes the entire chapter of Romans 6 to deal with this idea. That is the one idea of the tendency of humans to take advantage of the free grace of God. That's what chapter... Just give you a little hint. When you're studying the book of Romans, chapter 6 deals with this subject. So he says in verse 1, "What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound?" Certainly not. You know, absolutely not. This is not what he's saying, he says. He says in verse 15, "What then? Shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? Certainly not." That is, am I going to permit myself a compromise or two here and there just because, well, I know I'm under grace, so I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to think about it too much, you know. And God will always forgive me. He says, is that the attitude you should take? If you do, you don't understand grace. Because that's not what it's for. He even talks about here, he says, some of the response to grace that he gets into, he talks about, he says, look, sin cannot have and should not have dominion over you. That's the response of grace. He says, you are alive from the dead and alive to Christ and dead to sin. That's the response of grace. It changes everything for you if you understand this. How do we respond to grace? Well, that's what he covers in chapter 6. What should be your response? Let me put it this way. If a person knows that he has been afforded this grace, free, but undeserved, unearned pardon, and favor with God, the response should be to obey God in the purest conscience. If you realize what He has done for you personally, the great price that has been paid for your life, the undeserved favor you enjoy because of His calling, not who you are or what you've done, the response would be a more sensitive conscience about what goes on in your life and in your mind. It would result in a greater care to obey Him in all things. You would have a greater care in your own conscience not to let anything fall by the wayside. It should result in a greater love. It should result in a greater zeal before God. A person doesn't understand that, will make harder work of it. And they will tend to be operating more on their own. We have this discussion in Luke chapter 7, verse 36, about the person. Let me just cover it very briefly here. Luke chapter 7, the incident where Jesus was eating dinner at the home of Simon the Pharisee. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat, verse 36. He went to the Pharisee's house, sat down to eat. Behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus was at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears, wiped them with the hair of her head, and she kissed his feet, anointed them with fragrant oil. Would you do that? Simon didn't think he should. This woman was ready to do anything. We ought to ask why. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself saying, now this man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner this woman this is who is touching him, for she's a sinner. And Jesus answered and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, teacher, say it. I don't know if Simon suspected he was in trouble at this point, but he was in big trouble. There was a certain creditor that had two debtors. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. When they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me then, which of them will love him more? Simon answered and said, suppose the one whom he forgave the more. And he said to him, you rightly judged. And then he turned to the woman and he said to Simon, you see this woman? I entered your house. You didn't give me any water for my feet. She's washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Very interesting. She would do anything for God. She understood the gift. She understood how unworthy she was. See, it's a matter of the person coming to realize what they have to be forgiven of. Simon didn't get that. He just didn't get it. He was just as unworthy and found to be under sin just as much as this woman, but he wasn't filled with zeal. He wasn't filled with love for God, for Christ. He wasn't inspired to humility. Nothing like this happened in him. So you see, he was totally unaware of the grace of God. He didn't think he needed the grace of God. He was one of the ones that Paul spoke of who were trying to establish their righteousness by their works. Now, and I will tell you this, Simon the Pharisee was not a very happy man. I get the feeling this person here then was a very happy woman, knowing that she had been completely and totally forgiven. But Simon, I don't think was, because he was wrapped up in who he thought he was. Simon may have thought, you know, I'm not all that bad. In fact, I can actually make up anything I do wrong by doing a lot of good things, like maybe even putting on this feast for this man, his prophet right here, this righteous man. I'll put on the feast for him. I kind of make up for anything I may have done wrong. You know, you can almost see the attitude coming through here. People who see themselves as deserving aren't very happy people. They're generally complaining about what they never got, what they don't have, blaming other people for everything that's happened to them. They don't live by grace. They don't understand the grace of God. They don't appreciate the grace of God. If they did, they wouldn't be going down that same road. This woman was able to freely sacrifice and give herself unashamedly to serve Christ, willingly, without threat of punishment. Simon was not willing to give himself in any way, let alone wholeheartedly, to Christ to be taught by him. She knew what she had received. She knew it. Jesus shows the underlying motive for obedience to God. He said in John 14, verse 15, "If you love me, you will obey what I command." 14:21, "Who has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me." Verse 23, same chapter, "If anyone loves me, he will obey my teachings." We have very clear here why a person obeys God and worships Christ. Romans 12:1. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." Now, can we be moved by the mercies of God? Only if we know we have received mercy. That's the only way that you can present your body as a living sacrifice. Let me tell you something. First, people who are there because of their own merit, their own goodness, are not a living sacrifice. They are human. They're human doings, as we can say. They're just out there doing things. That's all they're doing. They haven't presented themselves. If you understand the mercies of God, you are prepared to serve Him wholeheartedly if you understand what you've been given. You see, David said that over and over again I will serve you, I will obey you with my whole heart. And when Nathan told him about the sin that he committed with Bathsheba, he said, you know how Nathan presented it? He said, "Don't you understand what I've given to you?" and you throw it right back in my face by doing this. You brought disgrace to me after, and everybody knows what I've given to you. I'm telling you, he's got a way of getting to a person. Now, and David, and that got to David. And David really repented. He deeply repented. I'm saying, this matter of obedience is not, I just got to sort of make myself do it. That's not the approach. If you understand grace, what you've been given, it doesn't take on the form of hard work. I'm going to get to that in just a minute. Let me cover 1 John chapter 4, this principle that he says here. 1 John chapter 4. The love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we loved God. That's the point we made to start with. We did not love God. People say, I just love God. Forget it. No, you don't. I'm sorry. People love themselves. They don't love God. If you love God, you'd really search out to find what He wants you to do. And that He loved us, and He sent His Son to be a propitiation for our sins. Beloved, God so loved us, we ought to love one another. What's the compelling reason for you to love somebody else? Because you found out God loved you. Otherwise, you'd have no reason to. I got no reason to love my enemies. In fact, I know what I'd do with my enemies. But there's one thing that stops me cold. What God has done for me. Because I was His enemy at one time. And don't come around and say, I was never God's enemy. Yes, you were. We all were. And if He then gave His very Son for you while you were still an enemy, and He demonstrated that kind of love for me, that's what compels me to love my neighbor, to love another, and to also love my enemy, and to go contrary to my nature, to hate my enemy. That's what makes me do it. Verse 19. We love Him because He first loved us. Don't get the idea we're so great and altruistic and wonderful and great that we just love God. We love Him because He first loved us. That's the way it works. A mother will take a child and love that child, sacrifice for that child, give her life for that child, hold that child, nurse that child, clean up that child, feed that child. That child sits there and squalls and just wants more. But the more you do it, that's the only way the child learns to return love. Which they do when? Later. Not as a baby. They don't understand that then. But they are recipients. They are recipients. Minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, from that mother. They are recipients of love. They don't return love. They just get it all the time, all the time, all the time. Okay? That person then, when they learn that, they grow up that way, then they learn to do it. How many children do you have out here who never had that? They are sociologically challenged. You understand the point? You understand? They have a problem dealing with people. They got serious problems. They got something went wrong in their childhood. That's the only way it works. You give, and you give, and you give, and you give. That's what God does for us. And then He expects a response. So we're talking about motivation. We're talking about motive. And that motive comes through the love of God. And if you are in any way mindful of your own works before God, then I will tell you, your worship is suspect. Okay? It's suspect. I know it's a little bit warm, folks, and we're into a deep subject here, but y'all just kind of just wipe the sweat off your brow here, and we're just going to keep plowing through it, okay? But this is important. I think if you're really into it, you're really into it, and I hope it's revealing and helpful. Now, let's get into this point that I brought a second ago. Some of you make hard work of your religion. It's almost like, if it doesn't hurt, it can't be okay. Or, if I don't struggle, I'm not really doing it. If it isn't hard, I'm not really obeying God. Somehow, I have to be made to obey God. And people generally say this sometimes whenever they try to explain the inherent evil within us or our sinful state, or they try to explain human nature. Oh, we just got to be made to obey God. All right. I got a question for you. Can you imagine God up there in heaven saying, boy, you know, I just have to just really make myself keep my own laws here. You know, I just really have to. Well, he's a spirit being. No, wait a minute. That's not the way it is. I heard Mr. Armstrong say that one time. He said, wait a minute, this is not the way it is. God's not up there just trying to, well, I just got to make myself do what's right, otherwise I might do what's wrong, you know. It's something it's a part of you. And there's something at the very basis of this. Matthew 11:27. Jesus expressed it this way. And I want to explain these scriptures because it helps us to understand what we're talking about here. And a lot of people don't understand what this means. And in fact, they've twisted this. But it should be understood in the context of what we're talking about here. Matthew 11, 27. Actually, 28. 28, that's the verse I want. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Wow. And we thought keeping God's law was harder. That's the way it's made out to be sometimes. He said, you come to me and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. And now it is a yoke. He's not saying it's not. He doesn't say that it's not something you have to deal with. It is. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle, or I am meek, really it should be, and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. A lot easier than doing it any other way. It's a lot easier. He said in Galatians 3, verses 1 through 3, he says, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed among you as crucified? This only I want to learn from you. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now being made perfect in the flesh? So Jesus himself even said, the flesh profits nothing. So we can be out here operating in the flesh and not in the Spirit, and we can really make hard work of it. Jesus said, I have come that they may have life, and that they may have life more abundantly. But he's not talking about physical riches there. He's talking about that spiritually, emotionally, that their life should be so much better than what it is. The devil keeps telling you, you're not good enough. And you know what? He's right. We're not. Give the devil his dues. He's right. We're not good enough. I'm not going to fight him on that one. Salvation is sure because of God's promise, Romans 4:16. Romans 4:16. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Doesn't matter where you are, doesn't matter where you came from, doesn't matter what your background. He made a promise. You can count on that promise. Is that how you live? That's what it means to live by grace. He promised. I'll take him up on that promise. If it relied on you, you wouldn't make it. So it would not be by promise if it rested on what you did. The results of trying to work out your salvation by seeing how much you can do is strife, anger, discontentment. And if this follows you around, you are not living by grace. Okay. Grace brings contentment. Let's move on to this point. Grace brings contentment. Why? Many are dissatisfied with what they've been given. I've seen this right in the church. The greatest cause of people being offended is that they didn't think what they got what they worked hard for. I've worked hard for this. You know, look what all I've done. This is what I deserve. Meaning, they thought they should have deserved more. They were looking at their works. They were not looking at God's generosity as to what they have already received, which may be quite sufficient, as he will read in just a moment. But you can get into the frame of mind that you must always do more. We must always become more. And sometimes you're subjecting yourself to stress. And a person who's stressed out all the time or stressed easily focuses on what they are. In other words, it's about them. A person who's susceptible to this sometimes comes from a background where the person themselves perhaps were belittled, disciplined, perhaps without love, maybe even abused, at least in their own minds, was not secure in the love of the home. The negative tended to be emphasized in the home. So the person is trying to prove themselves, trying to find acceptance by what they do and who they can become. And so that's their relationship with God. And it's a very stressful thing. So there can be a tendency to try to be better only to be accepted. But they will always come up with the idea, I'm never good enough. You know that term, I'm never good enough, is the most common term counselors have heard from grown children referring back to a troubled childhood. I was never good enough. I want you to think about that. I want you to think about what that does to a person. God says, okay, we're going to put this on a different basis. I'll set my love upon you. True, you're not good enough. Let's establish that fact. Let's establish it. You're not good enough. I tell you this, you will never be good enough. But I will make you good enough through Christ. Then you have free justification. You have free access to me. You come to me on His credentials, not yours. So you can have access for me, but that's how you're going to do it. What does that do for you? I want you to think about this. Does that remove stress? You see, if a person then understands that, why wouldn't they want to obey God? If they throw that back in God's face and go off and do whatever they want to do and disobey God, then they're really going to be in trouble. We'll see that in just a moment. But I want to refer to the parable in Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16. The parable of the vineyard, the workers in the vineyard. A lot of people don't understand this one. The kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for the vineyard, and when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing in the marketplace. And he said, whatever... You also go into the vineyard, whatever's right I'll give you. So they went. He went out the sixth hour. In the ninth hour he did likewise. In the 11th hour, the last hour of work, he went out and found others standing idle. And he said, why have you been standing idle here all day? Nobody's hired it. So he said, you go to the vineyard, and whatever's right I will give you. And so when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the last to the first. Those came who were hired about the 11th hour. They each received a denarius, and when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more, but they likewise received a denarius, and when they received it, they complained against the landowner. Big point here. They complained against the landowners, saying, "These have worked only 1 hour. You made them equal to us who have borne the burden and heat of the day." And he answered to one of them and said, "Friend, I didn't do you any wrong. I gave you exactly what we agreed. Take what's yours and go your way." In other words, you better quit complaining. You may not get hired after this, but that's going to be your attitude. If I want to give this last man the same as you, that's up to me. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things, or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last will be first, and the first last, for many are called, but few are chosen. This is a very interesting subject here, but you get the idea real quick. The point of the story is what each has received, and when they got what they agreed on, they expected more and criticized the landowner because they didn't get more. God wasn't doing anything wrong. If he wished to be generous to a person who, in the estimation of his fellow workers, didn't earn it, that's his business. This is by grace. That's the point of the parable. Not by what they earned. That's the point of this story here. God recognized what a person did, but in the end, people received what they got by grace. Let's cover a few final points here. Hebrews 12:15. Hebrews 12:15. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. A root of bitterness is falling short of the grace of God. Why? A person is bitter because they think they should have received more than the other person. That's it. Esau and Jacob. Esau was bitter. I should have got it. Why did he get it? I'm bitter. You fall from the grace of God, you don't realize what you've been given to start with. James 4:1-6. Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet, cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. Right there. You do not ask. He says, ask. And you do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. You can go the world's way on this, but it's not going to work. Do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? That word Spirit should not be in a capital letter, because that is not, I've checked the various authorities on this, and they try to make it sound something else. What he says here, don't you understand that there is something within inside of us that is just jealous? That's what he's saying. However, he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. So what do you need? Doesn't matter what you need. It doesn't matter how much of it you need. He gives more grace. He can do that. Wars and strife come from people who are out here doing things on their own. They're going to get for themselves, and they've gone down that road, and that's the road of the world. 2 Corinthians 12:7. 2 Corinthians 12:7. What if you're not getting healed? Even. And lest I should be exalted, 2 Corinthians 12:7, above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing I pleaded with the Lord 3 times, that it might depart from me. Whatever this thing was, he doesn't tell you. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. Without getting into the whole thing here, I think we know pretty much know the story. We don't always get what we want. You and I have every argument in the book that we ought to receive what we think we need or we want. It says he pleaded with God. Sounds like he really wanted this to be removed. The answer he got was, my grace is sufficient. What's that mean? You have been pardoned. You are accepted by me. What you have is freely given. I am not trying to validate you, Paul, by healing you. You're in. Don't worry. You're in. And if he was going to be healed, it was going to be a gift. And let us not go before God to hold before him anything that we do, or make our case that he ought to give us our request. Our requests are just that. Our requests are requests. They're not demands. Whenever I anoint a person and I ask for God to heal them, I specifically mention, we come before you not based upon anything we have done, but we are here simply to ask. That's it. We are not deserving. We shouldn't by rights have it, but we're simply asking, would you grant it? That's the prayer. That's it. You start qualifying it by something else, I think you're going to have a problem with it when getting through to God. People who live by grace don't see trials as punishment from God. They don't see it that way. They say, I'm under God's grace. That's where I live. And I am in God's hands. He says, therefore I take pleasure in my infirmities. The Greek means I am contented. I am contented. I don't have any complaints. I live. That's where I live. Galatians 5 verses 1 through 6. Let's conclude with this. Galatians 5. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty in which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. Indeed, I, Paul, say to you that if you become circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing. And I testify again to every man who becomes circumcised that he is a debtor to keep the whole law. In other words, if that's the route you want to go down to become justified before God, then you're going to be obligated. You've got to keep that entire law. And I got news for you. You can't do it. Oh yes, you got to have the righteous requirements of the law satisfied within you. And the righteous requirement of the law says this: you got to die because of your sin. That righteous requirement will be paid. And one problem, one thing you got going for you: somebody else paid it. But it will be paid. God will not diminish one bit from His law. And he will not take the penalty away or the consequences from his law. He will not do it. So it's got to be paid. Christ did it. Now, if you're going to try to do this by circumcision, which was only a sign of a covenant, it wasn't a part of the law. He says, if you're going to go down that road, you are a debtor to keep every bit of that law without fail. And let's see how well you do. You have become estranged from Christ, you who attempt to be justified by the law. You have fallen from grace. That's what he says here. There was an approach to salvation in their relationship with God that depended on their works. Circumcision was a part of it, and whatever else that they required. Paul says, if you're going to require circumcision, then you're taking a route that you have to satisfy all the law, and that's something you can't do. You're either saved by grace or you're not. That's the way it works. We are rewarded according to our works. God wants to know how you're going to respond to His love and His grace. It tells Him what you think about Him. It tells him whether you believe and obey the first and great commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. That's what the response to God's grace tells him, whether you're going to do that. When obedience is done with a view to meriting salvation or God's blessing on our lives, we have the wrong motive, and we will have a false gospel. That's what the book of Galatians is all about. Under grace, obedience is a loving response to salvation, which has already been provided by Christ, and the assurance that, having provided salvation, God will also, through Christ, provide everything else that you need. The only obedience acceptable to God is compelled by love, constrained by His love, as it says in another place, and because love is the fulfillment of God's law. God's law prescribes our duty, but love provides the correct motive for obedience. We obey God's law not to be loved, but we obey it because we are already loved. God's law is not opposed to grace, nor is it the enemy of grace. Neither is the law of God opposed to us as we seek to live by grace. To live by grace means that we understand that God's blessing on our lives is not dependent on our level of obedience, but we are continually blessed because of the perfect obedience of Christ. It means that out of a grateful response to the grace of God, we seek to understand His will and to obey Him. Not to be blessed, but because we are already blessed. Okay, thank you very much.